The past few months have seen a handful of police shootings, including in Arizona, and that's led to protests. So now Arizona cops say they need some more protection.
We just felt that keeping the officer's name in this day and age redacted for a period of time was prudent.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, the controversy over a cooling off period. Also, does the Super Bowl really lead to an increase in sex trafficking?
A Far East Valley city wants to drive its way to more cash.
And puppets after dark.
It's kind of cool because, you know, you work with kids all the time, and so you're just minding your P's and Q's, and then all of a sudden you can kind of let loose a little bit with the adult shows.
Plus, a master comes to Phoenix and veggies come to a garden in Mesa.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ along with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. It'll stay windy throughout the valley into tonight. We're looking for overnight lows to be in the mid to upper 40s. For tomorrow, sunny and again breezy with a high near 67. But this weekend, it should be sunny with high temperatures in the lower to mid 70s. Currently under sunny skies, it is 62 degrees.
Arizona's unemployment rate has dropped again. State Department of Administration economists say the state's seasonally adjusted unemployment rate for December was 6.7%. That's down from 6.8% in both October and November and 6.9% in September. The national unemployment rate decreased 0.2 percentage point to 5.6% last month. Six of the 11 major sectors in Arizona added jobs. Five reported losses over the month. Overall, the state added 7,000 non-farm jobs in December.
Arizona is among the states with the worst highway safety laws, according to a report by Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety. It is one of only seven states that doesn't have a ban on texting and driving. Michelle Donati is with AAA.
Arizona is unfortunately one of the few remaining states without such law. There are a few ordinances around the state that do address this issue, but really until there's a comprehensive statewide ban on the practice, people think they can do it in one place and not the other.
The advocacy group report highlights other lax traffic laws that contribute to danger on the roadways. State law doesn't require motorcyclists over age 17 to wear helmets, and police officers can only cite drivers for not wearing seatbelts when they're pulled over for another roadway violation. Speaking of the roadways, a quick check of Valley traffic. There is one accident to watch out for. It's on the 51 southbound at Glendale.
Some Arizona law enforcement officials want to delay releasing the names of police officers involved in shootings. They're working with state lawmakers on a bill which could be filed in the next week. The initial talk had centered on a 90-day so-called cooling-off period after a shooting, although that could change. Mike Williams represents the Arizona Police Association and the Phoenix Law Enforcement Association.
We're kind of in a new day, and there's a lot of things are getting more politically charged on these shootings than they have been in the past. And with the protests in Ferguson, with the protests in Arizona, and the ones in New York, you know, we just felt that keeping the officer's name in this day and age redacted for a period of time was prudent. Not that we're looking to redact any of the details or the officer's employment record or any of that, but in today's technologically advanced society, it is so easy to get somebody's home address. Now, whether it's 90 days or whether we're looking, one of the members has suggested we look at until the determination is made by the county attorney's office, which actually seems very reasonable to us. We're going to pursue one of those two roads, but my guess is we're going to be pursuing, and I have not talked to the member yet, we may be pursuing until the county attorney's office makes a determination on the validity of the shooting itself.
Would it just be the officer's name that is withheld? I mean, you mentioned employment history, other things like that. Would that all be released sooner?
Yeah, we're not interested in redacting any of the facts from the public other than the officer's name to protect the officer from being attacked in his home or having retribution taken out on the officer.
So I'm curious that, you know, given technology and sort of sleuthing that can happen online, what's to stop somebody from sort of connecting the dots and figuring out who the officer is? I mean, you know what department they're from. It's sort of a limited universe of potential officers after that, right?
Well, if you have, you know, like in Phoenix, you have 2,500 officers, and the details of the shooting should be released to the media as soon as the investigation is underway and the facts that are known. We're not looking to redact those.
Absent threats and protesting at an officer's home, and perhaps, you know, harassment of family and neighbors and things like that, what's wrong with the public knowing which public servant, a police officer, was involved in a shooting in their community?
Well, I think you have to look at which is the more important factor. The public's right to know, and certainly the details of the public's right to know, we're not trying to impede that. They will know the circumstances of the shooting. When you're releasing an officer's name, there's already laws on the books that redact a lot of that information. Unfortunately, people and the press have gotten very sophisticated now, and even though the officer's name and or the address is always supposed to be redacted, it really takes less than about 24 hours to find out where they live. What we're trying to avoid is two things. We don't want a member of the public that may be emotionally charged showing up to the officer's house, and then another injury occurs, and we certainly don't want the officer's family or the officer harassed. And I don't know, you know, whether it's Joe Smith or Bob Ryan or you know, whatever the name is, that should be of little consequence to most of the people that are reading the news and wanting to know what's going on in their community.
Mike Williams is a lobbyist representing the Arizona Police Association and the Phoenix Law Enforcement Association.
The proposal is not being met with praise by everyone. Tia Oso is the Arizona organizer with the group Black Alliance for Just Immigration. She says there's no reason to withhold information since there are no secret police in this country.
It's unfortunate that a lack of transparency and delays of information, which should be public information and promptly given, is their tactic instead of really examining themselves and looking for ways that they can be more responsible and more accountable to communities.
Tia Oso is Arizona organizer with the group Black Alliance for Just Immigration.
A bill introduced yesterday in the state legislature would set aside money to help children who are being sexually exploited online. The measure sponsor, Republican State Representative Paul Boyer of Phoenix, says Arizona's Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force rescued 70 kids last year despite being under-resourced.
We are actually sitting on a disaster right now. We have 15,000 leads of people that we know of that are trading child pornography in the state of Arizona. And that doesn't even include walk-in reports, cyber tips, or other reported crimes. And we only have 4 full-time investigators in the entire state of Arizona to investigate these leads.
So what does your bill then propose to do about it?
So it's taken me about 6 months. I've been trying to find a way with general fund being what it is in the budget. So I'm taking $5 million, from the Lottery Commission. So after all the prizes are paid out and there's other beneficiaries that are currently in statute, after that's all paid out, $4.5 million to hire full-time investigators and forensic examiners to go after these guys, and then $500,000 for a victim's fund.
And would these people be employed by DPS?
Well, actually, the way I have the language drafted is the Attorney General, Mark Brnovich, would draft an IGA with any federally approved ICAC or Internet Crimes Against Children task force. Right now, it's just this, through the city of Phoenix, but I would love it if other agencies, and this funding might create that opportunity for other agencies to start their own units. And so they work right now with affiliate agencies, so Scottsdale, Tucson, and other part-time guys. But right now, they're not proactively going after these guys.
Do you have a sense of how many more investigators that money would be able to hire?
Yeah, I'm looking at around 30 to 35.
And how much of a dent do you think that would put in the problem?
Not enough, but it's better than nothing. I mean, I'm asking for $5 million. That's 0.05% of a $9 billion budget. So I'm not asking for the world here, but it would make a huge difference for these kids that are actively being raped, tortured, and abused right now.
So if you're proposing to use leftover lottery money to hire these investigators, are you basically dependent then on people continuing to play lottery games? I mean, is this money that is guaranteed to be there year after year?
I am, and I can't think of a better use of lottery money. And according to our nonpartisan budget staff, they're projecting $25 million in the lottery. And the Lottery Commission has told me that they're pretty convinced that the money will be there. It's actually increased year over year for the last 3 years.
But that's still kind of and please pardon the pun, that's still a bit of a gamble, though, isn't it? I mean, people could stop playing the lottery for whatever reason.
I agree, and it's always going to be a gamble, but here's the problem. This has to be ongoing funding, and I don't want to make this a one-time appropriation because no law enforcement is going to hire an officer that they need training for 18 to 24 months when they know that next year the money may not be there. And so I was looking for an ongoing funding stream that made sense, and it took me about 6 months, but this was as far as I'm concerned, the best way to do it. If there's other ideas to get there to make sure it's ongoing, then I am all ears.
State Representative Paul Boyer, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
He described the situation in Arizona, but what about the rest of the country? For that, we turn to David Finkelhor. He's the director of the Crimes Against Children Research Center at the University of New Hampshire. I asked him if law enforcement agencies are seeing more incidents of this now than in past years.
The usage of the internet and electronic media for all kinds of things has been growing, so it's not surprising that that would be growing as well. I mean, everything has been growing in terms of the electronic media, but at the same time, overall crime has been going down. Overall, sex crimes against children are down in this country, even though the internet and the electronic media portion of them is up. And so that suggests that the kinds of things that law enforcement have been doing overall have been having some effect, that we should be encouraged. And although, you know, there really are challenges online, we shouldn't get the mindset that somehow we're not making strides in this issue.
How are states equipped to handle this?
Well, it's complicated. On the one hand, the technology affords new opportunities for criminals, but it also affords new opportunities for law enforcement. So, you know, certainly, for example, the number of images that exist online of sex crimes against children has increased enormously. But at the same time, the ability of law enforcement to detect them and to find the people who are trading them and using them has increased. So it's improved their ability, in fact, to find and prosecute offenders as well.
Do you find that states and agencies within those states have enough resources, enough people to investigate these crimes and to track down the people who are trafficking in them?
Well, there's been a big expansion of capabilities in this area with funding from the federal government under the Internet Crimes Against Children legislation, and there's been a lot of people who've gotten training and a lot of task forces that have been set up around the country to respond to these kinds of crimes. I'm sure they would tell you that they don't have enough resources because, you know, law enforcement feels like they never do. But my sense is that this is an area where the government has responded well, and we certainly could use more, but it's not like it's nothing is going on. There have been a number of really important breakthroughs for law enforcement. For example, their ability to run undercover operations. You know, it was very hard to impersonate a 12-year-old child, have an adult law enforcement officer do that when it required face-to-face communication. But once people were talking on the internet, that became an investigative technique that has really identified and brought in a lot of offenders.
David Finkelhor directs the Crimes Against Children Research Center at the University of New Hampshire.
Target, Home Depot, Neiman Marcus, depending on your shopping preferences, some good weekend errand stops. But these are also companies that were recently hit hard by cybersecurity breaches. Paul Steinbart is W.P. Carey School Professor of Information Systems at ASU. Paul, are companies responding effectively to those breaches when they happen?
At first, when I think about responding, I'm thinking about, okay, it happened, and so now are they responding? Are they dealing with the situation appropriately? And I'd have to say that sometimes they are, but other times they probably could do better. I have my students, and I have them read an article that was written 20 years ago in Harvard Business Review called Managing the Crisis You Tried to Prevent. And one of the key points that's in there, why I have them read that one, is they're going to run into incidents. There's no company out there that's bulletproof. So they need to know how to respond when something does happen and when it does go wrong. And this article stresses that the key is to focus on the big picture and how the public perceives what happened and how the company is responding to what happened. The best way to do that is to talk about it. And there's a quote in the article from Warren Buffett, who said that what you should do is state clearly that you do not know all the facts, then promptly state the facts you do know, and get it right, get it quick, get it out, and get it over with. Problem's not going to get any better with age. End of quote.
Does that necessarily give the public confidence that it won't happen again, or they'll fix it before it could happen again?
that's the thing that companies need to be clear about, is what are they going to do, what are they going to do to make sure that they've learned from this experience so it doesn't, the exact same thing doesn't happen again. It's better if you get breached because of some new attack than if you get breached the same way that happened, 5 years ago to somebody else.
Are security breaches part of the cost of doing business? Do corporations now in some ways sort of build that in, thinking, okay, we're a credit card company. Even if this particular person shopped at Target but didn't have their card or whatever compromised, we're just going to be proactive, send them a new card. Is the cost of that sort of thing built into what they already do?
It probably is becoming built in, because it would be a prudent thing to do. You mentioned credit cards. I mean, for years, they know that there's going to be a percentage of people who aren't going to pay, and so they factor that in. Companies have always known that inventory control is never 100%. There's always going to be some loss and theft, some shrinkage, as they call it. If they're prudent, they probably set aside, they've got some reserves to help cover a situation like that.
So responding, as you said, is about an after-the-fact thing. So as companies move forward, even if they're not bulletproof, are there methods that are being used that you've heard about that will make breaches less likely? Or are companies not as invested in those sorts of things, even as we hear more about breaches in the public sense?
Well, there's certainly a lot you can do to reduce the risks. And I'm just saying that the reason I say nobody's bulletproof is that you can reduce the risks so that you are not an easy target. And therefore, you won't be a victim of just circumstance. But it's probably almost impossible to reduce the risk to zero of if you're being targeted, especially if you're being targeted by, say, a nation state or a large criminal organization. But if you're just a victim of circumstance, it's sort of like the burglar that comes up and tries your door, and if the door is locked or if he sees a sign that says you got a home burglar alarm, he'll probably go to the neighbor who doesn't have that sign in front of their house.
Paul Steinbart, W.P. Carey School Professor of Information Systems at ASU. He says government agencies are facing similar challenges and, at least in most cases, should respond the same way corporations do.
Still to come, a rare peek inside the mind of an artistic master.
You see drawings of water movement and waves in water that you then see replicated in his figural work, and you find it in the hair of the Mona Lisa.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. If you're on the Valley freeways, looks like a smooth ride. We're not getting any reports of accidents or heavy slowing. Valley weather for the rest of today, it'll stay breezy on into tonight as well. We should have clear skies with lows in the mid to upper 40s. For tomorrow, again, sunny and breezy with a high around 67. We should warm to the lower 70s under sunny skies for Saturday, and then by Sunday, highs in the upper 70s. Currently, with relative humidity at 12%, we have fair skies, 62 degrees at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by Phoenix Symphony. The high-flying Cirque de la Symphonie performs live with the symphony, featuring strongmen and gravity-defying aerialists. Two shows at the Mesa Arts Center Saturday, January 31st. PhoenixSymphony.org.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein.
Globally, research estimates that several million people are currently in situations in which they're being forced into sexual trafficking situations, and conventional wisdom says that type of exploitation increases around major sporting events. With the Super Bowl approaching in the Valley in a little over a week, Richard Ruelas of the Arizona Republic and AZ Central wrote about it for last Sunday's edition. I started by asking him whether the premise that there's more sex trafficking related to the big game is accurate.
That premise is false. It's a great media myth. It's going to get repeated again. It has been a tale that has been repeated not just with the Super Bowl, but with the World Cup, with any large-scale events. Earlier this year, the McCain Institute funded a study that ASU did. There's an institute at ASU that looks at the sex trafficking issue. And they looked at whether sex trafficking increased in New York, New Jersey during last year's Super Bowl and found that it didn't.
So why do you think this urban legend persists then? Why do people still think that's the case?
This idea that women are being especially forced to come into a city and serve as sexual slaves for the perverted men who are here for the sporting event works well. And you have serious sounding experts talking about it. And so, you know, a lot of reporters will fall into that because it seems like a Super Bowl adjacent story.
Does that false premise in any way affect whether, does that take away the seriousness of the problem? Does it help actually make it easier to solve the problem because people are more focused at least on the issue?
The advocates will say that the attention is great, that even though it's not really, that we don't see a spike during the Super Bowl, that the attention is great. They'll say that if you're worried about it being at the Super Bowl, great, because it's not just at the Super Bowl. This problem exists all year round. The tales of this crime can be horrific. In 2005, in Phoenix, what became known as the Dog Crate case, where a girl was kidnapped, taken to an apartment, kept in a dog crate for the first few days of her confinement, and then was forced to serve as a prostitute. Her captor had mentally broken her by keeping her in a dog crate, and she was sold on the internet. So that is a horrific crime, which when you read the police report is even more gruesome and awful and cruel than I can relate over these public airwaves.
Mm-hmm. From the people you spoke to, was there an ability to separate or discuss this concept of, yes, we're concerned about children being trafficked and put into sex slavery, whatever it may be, and the fact that there are some, though it may be a very small percentage, who actually voluntarily choose this profession?
Yeah, and that's where it gets murky. I don't think anyone would argue that if there is someone, especially underage, but even as an adult, in working as a prostitute, under force, under gunpoint, tied up, that's not something we should stop. People would all be on board for that. The question gets to the woman walking down Van Buren Street, say, the prostitute, what we would think of normally as a prostitute. How much, and the word they choose is agency, how much choice does she have? Is she there because she really wants to be, or is she there because there's not many options for her? Maybe she doesn't have a great education. Maybe she's addicted to drugs or alcohol. Maybe there is some guy around her who's encouraging her to do this, even if he's not actively forcing her. But there are activists who now say that you could be trafficked by your drug addiction. You could be trafficked by your life circumstances. You need money to feed your kid. The street prostitute is now seen as a trafficking victim, even though it's not what would be conjured up in most people's minds when they hear the word trafficked. And even as social agencies try to rescue women, or as police officers try to rescue women from a life of prostitution or sex trafficking, they find it's difficult. And a lot of the social agencies say one of their most difficult challenges is convincing the woman she is a victim, that she has been trafficked and she needs to get out.
Did the premise of legalization, regulation come up? This idea that draws the line even more clearly based on children being trafficked and adults making their own decision.
Police have now, with the way they enforce the laws, have essentially said we are not going to treat the woman as a criminal anymore. There is still the coercion of maybe some jail time if you don't complete the diversion program we're about to offer you. But police now are saying, we are not going to just toss you in jail, let you out in a couple days, and return you to the streets. We are going to try to intervene here. And if you wish to go to a diversion program, we will try to give you as much help as we can to get you out. We will give you services. We'll put you in contact with people who will give you an education, give you state government help. We'll do what we can to get you out.
Richard Ruelas of the Arizona Republic and AZ Central, part two of his series on sex trafficking, will run on Sunday.
One of the world's greatest artists is coming to Phoenix. Okay, not the artist himself, but one of his works. Leonardo da Vinci's Codex Lester will be on display at the Phoenix Art Museum starting on Saturday. Jerry Smith is the museum's curator of American and European Art to 1950 and Art of the American West.
What this is a remarkable opportunity for our community to have a chance to see works actually by the hand of Leonardo da Vinci. This is the Codex Lester, which are 18 sheets in which he recorded his observations on nature. And looking primarily at water and the movement of water and control of water.
It sounds a little bit like a combination of journal and sketchbook.
It is. Leonardo, well, what it is the first example of notebooks of a scientist, and in which he observed nature closely, and returned again and again to make observations, to jot down his notes and his theories.
On a timeline, where does this object fall in the scope of Leonardo's work and some of the other art that he produced?
He created this in, well, it's not dated specifically, but it's been determined it was written around 1508 to 1510. And that is getting towards the end of his life. He lived to 1519. And it actually falls into that period when he's painting the Mona Lisa, which he painted from 1503 to 1517. And that's one of the fascinating things about this codex. You see examples, you see drawings of water movement and waves in water that you then see replicated in his figural work, and you find it in the hair of the Mona Lisa in the same kind of patterns. So you see how his observations of nature are informing his painting.
How do you try to make this relevant to today's audience? I mean, this is several hundred years old now, and yes, Leonardo da Vinci is one of the most well-known artists of all time, but still, I mean, it's not new, necessarily, this work.
Right. And what we wanted to do, while the Codex Lester is a scientific document, we're not a science museum. We're an art museum. And so we decided to kind of explore the ideas of Leonardo's practices of close observation and how we see that playing out through the centuries. And so we are taking it out of Leonardo specific and broadening the ideas of emphasizing curiosity, close observation, and thinking on paper or working through problems and finding a solution.
How big of a deal is it for the Phoenix Art Museum to have this item, this object from Leonardo da Vinci being displayed in it?
Oh, it's a terrific opportunity for the community and for the museum to be able to showcase works by the hand of arguably the best known artist of all time. You know, his paintings, Mona Lisa and The Last Supper, possibly the best known paintings in the world, and to have works by him, which are so rare, it's a huge opportunity for us.
Jerry Smith is curator of American and European Art to 1950 and Art of the American West at Phoenix Art Museum. Da Vinci's Codex Lester will be on display at the museum through April 12th, and by way of full disclosure, the Phoenix Art Museum is an underwriter of KJZZ.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
One and two. One and two.
My name is Steve Conrad.
Step, one step.
I'm a dance instructor.
Now this is the essence of swing music.
And tonight we're swing dancing.
Four, five, six.
My name is Kelly Weaver.
My name is Bill Weaver, and I just decided to bring my wife. We saw some YouTube video of people doing the Lindy Hop.
And we just thought it'd be something fun to try to do.
Lift, turn. And rock, step, and turn, and catch both hands, and stop right there.
I've learned a lot. I mean, we learned two basic moves tonight that gets us to where we can enjoy dancing with each other.
I call this move the Cabbage Patch. It's named after a hip-hop move in the 90s.
We want to be able to go out and, like, just go to jazz clubs and not feel, like, totally intimidated.
Yeah. We're not professionals at all, but we're having a great time.
That's Kelly and Bill Weaver dancing with instructor Steve Conrad at 101 Gallery in downtown Mesa. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or if you think we have two left feet, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
Coming up, Apache Junction may be putting ads on some of its city vehicles, but not every kind of sponsor would be welcome.
Those include businesses that have tobacco products, sexually oriented businesses, weapons, political affiliations.
Rolling advertisements, that's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. Checking the Valley freeways at this hour. One serious accident. It's I-10 eastbound at 7th Street. Center lanes are blocked there, and you're backed up with very heavy slowing to at least 19th Avenue. Valley weather for tonight should stay clear and breezy with lows in the mid to upper 40s. Sunny and breezy tomorrow with a high of 67. Then high temperatures over the weekend into the mid to upper 70s under sunny skies. It's currently sunny and 62 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by John C. Lincoln Health Foundation, thanking donors who help support John C. Lincoln Health Network in providing medical and community services to those in need. On the web at jcl.com/foundation.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Obama is trying to prove that America is not as divided as all the arguing in Washington would have us believe. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, that's why he took his pitch for early childhood education funding to Kansas.
Obama visited a Head Start classroom in Lawrence, Kansas. It's part of his efforts to sell his proposal for expanded high-quality child care. The school visit was followed by remarks at the University of Kansas.
You give parents support and you give a child that little boost at the beginning, it lasts a lifetime.
Obama said he didn't want anyone to be, quote, daycare poor. Obama has long pushed for universal pre-K, though Congress hasn't shared that priority. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Lawrence, Kansas.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu comes to Washington in March, but a visit to the White House is not on the agenda. Instead, Republican House Speaker John Boehner invited the Israeli leader to address a joint meeting of Congress about the threat posed by Iran. Congress will consider new sanctions against Tehran over its nuclear program. But House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi says Netanyahu shouldn't be lobbying Congress for more sanctions on Iran while delicate talks are underway.
If that's the purpose of Prime Minister Netanyahu's visit 2 weeks before his own election, right in the midst of our negotiations, I just don't think it's appropriate.
And President Obama also wants Congress to hold off on new sanctions, saying they could hamper international negotiations. Wall Street ended the day higher today, the Dow gaining 259 points to close at 17,813. That's up nearly a half percent. The Nasdaq gained 82 points to close at 4,750. That's up 1.7%. And the S&P 500 gaining 31 points to close at 2063. This is NPR News.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. If you just tuned in, you'll want to know about this in traffic. I-10 eastbound at 7th Street. A serious accident has the center lanes blocked, and it has you backed up several miles.
Arizona's public schools may go a few years without letter grades. The State Board of Education wants to look at how they're calculated and see if that needs to be changed. Christine Thompson, the board's executive director, says the letter grades are calculated based both on statutory requirements, but also how well students are doing and how much they're improving.
The largest portion of the A through F school letter grades is based on calculations that are determined by the performance of students on the statewide assessment.
And that statewide assessment obviously is changing this school year. Ames is gone, AZ Merit is in. What is it about that changeover that is leading to some potential confusion about how those grades will be calculated?
It's really not about the confusion about how those grades will be calculated. It's really about taking an opportunity to take a step back and look at our letter grading system. We've had a school accountability system in place since Prop 301 passed in 2000. The legacy system turned into the A through F school grades about 5 years ago. And we have an opportunity to look back after there have been numerous changes in state and federal laws that impact school accountability, to take a step back and say, you know, now that we have a new assessment, now that we've had time using the accountability system that we have, what improvements can we make to it? So the fact that we have a new assessment presents an opportunity for us to, one, set a baseline so we can can compare performance on the new assessment, which measures new standards that are now fully implemented, but also gives us an opportunity to look at other issues like what other criteria should be used in the A through F letter grades, and how should our A through F system be constructed.
Are there flaws or problems with the current system of calculating those grades that is leading to wanting to take this opportunity to maybe revisit it and change it somewhat?
I think over the years, it's become relatively complex. When you're talking about analyzing the growth of students from year to year, there are multiple ways to do that. Every year, there are new pieces that are included in the letter grading system, and we thought this would be a good opportunity to take a step back, look and see what's been included, maybe some of the things that aren't included that are important to parents and families. Should those things be a part of an academic letter grade? Or should they be part of a broader report card that we present to families as they make decisions?
How long do you expect this whole process of relooking at the letter grade and calculation system to take?
The piece of legislation would ask for a 3-year transition period. We're hopeful that by the end of next year, by the beginning of the next legislative session in 2016, we'll have proposed changes to legislation that will allow us to make policy changes at the board level.
So in the interim then, how should parents and families be looking at schools and trying to figure out if it's a good school for their kids to be going to?
We're going to be working with the department to publish all of the indicators that have been in the past a part of the letter grade system as we consider new indicators, having those published online.
Christine Thompson is Executive Director of the Arizona Board of Education.
Apache Junction city vehicles may soon look like moving advertisements if the city council decides to go forward with a proposal. The city had been approached by a potential sponsor and has done some initial research on whether to put ads on 26 of the vehicles. Constance Hallinan-Wilson is a public information specialist for Apache Junction.
There's actually another entity in town, the Superstition Fire Medical District, who currently does participate in a vehicle advertising program. And they're working with PSA, which is Public Safety Advertising. So we had a representative from PSA come and address our city council, given that they are working with another entity in our community. And as a result of that meeting, council asked staff to work with PSA to develop a potential vehicle program for our city to consider.
Can you give me an idea of how much money perhaps the city would hope to raise, how much the city needs to raise? I know that even in this post-recession time, many communities around the valley and around the state are still struggling with budgets.
Absolutely. So, you know, since the recession in 2008, a lot of municipalities are looking at alternative revenue sources, and this is just one example of something that may be beneficial. So given PSA's experience, we look to them to develop the packages, and their recommendation in the proposed program would be 5 packages. And given how much exposure those vehicles get and the mileage and all those factors that they weigh into it, the revenue, projected revenue for the packages would vary from approximately $11,000 a year to just under $60,000 a year, depending on which package a company chose to go with.
Have the council heard from folks who are enthusiastic, who are less enthusiastic, and those who are less so? Have they expressed any specific concerns about this?
You know, because we're still very much in the research phases, we haven't gone into depth with that yet, but that's one of the things that we're really focusing on now is, you know, getting a feel from the community and doing some outreach in our own community. And so we haven't had anyone come forward yet with any strong opposition or any strong support of it, but those are some of the things that we're looking into now.
Are there certain types of ads that the city just wouldn't want associated with it?
Absolutely, absolutely. One thing that the council felt very strongly on is not having any advertising on our police vehicles. So the 26 vehicles identified, none of them are in the police department's fleet. And some other restrictions, of course, are that there are some businesses that would be excluded from participation, and those include businesses that have tobacco products, sexually oriented businesses, weapons, political affiliations. And the way that the proposed program would work is that the city would have the ability to decline a business partnership. However, it would really have to factor in that they're protecting and preserving the public health, the general public view. So while there are certain businesses that would automatically be excluded, the city still would have the right to exclude any other businesses as long as the decision was related to a government purpose.
If the ads are appropriate and things are approved, would there be any reason for a city employee to feel odd driving a vehicle that has an ad on it in addition to Apache Junction on it?
Being a city employee and of course, dealing with the public and the media, I absolutely do care about the program. I can't speak for individuals, how they might feel with it. I'm sure that there may potentially be some employees who may be for the program and may be against the program for their own personal reasons. But I think that that's why it's so important that we're taking our time and weighing all the pros and cons and looking at all sides of this before we make any definite decisions.
Constance Hallinan-Wilson, Public Information Specialist for the City of Apache Junction. She says if the car ad program goes forward, it would likely start as a pilot project.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein. Quick check of Valley traffic. I-10 eastbound at 7th Street. Delays there due to an earlier accident back to 27th Avenue.
KJZZ is supported by Wild Horse Pass Hotel and Casino, presenting Engelbert Humperdinck on stage Valentine's Day, Saturday, February 14th. His hits include Please Release Me and Quando, Quando, Quando. Engelbert tickets at WinHelaRiver.com.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Three of the most memorable recent movies about America's experience in war have not been about winning or losing.
When I go home, people ask me, hey, Hoot, why do you do it, man?
Black Hawk Down was about a small skirmish in Somalia that ended badly for American troops in an unresolved and forgotten war.
What's the best way to go about disarming one of these things?
The way you don't die, sir.
Hurt Locker was about a man's life trapped in the destiny of disarming deadly IED explosives in Iraq.
Hey, Mikey, I'm about ready to punch that time card. Do it.
Lone Survivor was about an ill-fated patrol in Afghanistan and a futile, pointless battle against the Taliban. The new Clint Eastwood film, American Sniper, was the surprise highest-grossing movie of the holiday weekend. The film stars Bradley Cooper and is based on the real story of U.S. Navy SEAL and elite sniper Chris Kyle.
Tell me why you do it.
Come on.
I want to understand.
Babe, I do it for you. You know that I do it to protect you.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do.
I'm here. Your family is here. Your children have no father.
You'll have to serve my country.
You don't know when to quit.
Sniper, distinct from the other films I mentioned, has had great success at the box office. The other films are download hits and very popular with Iraq and Afghanistan vets. Is there something about this Eastwood film, finding an American winner in Chris Kyle's story? Or is it timing? Americans are finally able to more deeply examine the consequences of the Iraq experience for the first time. Robert McKee is an award-winning author and lecturer on film. What do you think is going on with American Sniper? Some folks have tweeted that it represents a kind of closure for some veterans, and that's what the success is about. What do you think?
Well, I'm sure that's part of it. I know that there was a tremendous curiosity in America to understand this war and try to understand what it was like to fight in this war, what the point of the war was. In the same way that many years ago, Apocalypse Now raised the same sort of big questions in America's mind about Vietnam, but it didn't answer them very well. This film, I think, does address those questions. But I think it's more than that. I mean, when Hollywood, when people try to go back and figure out what's a hit and what's a miss and why, there's always some magic. There's always something that's really unexplainable in the kind of chemistry that connects between a film and an audience and makes such an enormous difference.
What we experienced after Vietnam, I remember, was, you know, there was Apocalypse Now, which was a very much an anti-war film, it seemed. And then you had movies like Platoon, which was very much, and Rambo, which, you know, really ratcheted up a sense of the point of view of American soldiers. Will we see similar kinds of arguments, distinct views of the war playing out on the screen as we get away from the Iraq and Afghanistan experiences?
It's possible. I mean, war is, I hate to say this, but a kind of gold mine for storytelling. The conflict is instantaneous. The morality has to be sorted out. And I think one of the reasons for the success of American Sniper is that it does try its best to somehow sort out the morality. I mean, in the past, the notion of being a sniper always had a negative connotation, no matter who was sniping. I mean, it's an ambush. It just always seems somehow unfair. To turn that into a positive is, in a sense, a one way, at least, to rationalize America in the Middle East. There's a lot of negative feelings throughout the country about our involvement from 9/11 on.
Certainly, there's something about the experience of seeing the film that is moving people. And I'm wondering if the metaphor of Americans being in a kind of sniper's perch, civilians back home in the United States, projecting American power into the Middle East is a deliberate metaphor on Clint Eastwood's part. And what about PTSD? It seems like this movie makes PTSD a much more mainstream experience for the millions of soldiers coming back.
Yes, and of course, all of these films, by the way, are all biopics. Hurt Locker, Lone Survivor, Black Hawk Down, they're all about, you know, real guys. And in this story, this poor protagonist manages to overcome all of that terrible stress and disruption of war, only to be killed by somebody who could not. And the irony of that is pretty grim. So there is some positive, certainly, sense of a guy surviving the war and coming home in this film, but it's ironized repeatedly, and so I can't feel that people felt a particular uplift from this film, but I think it did help satisfy, answer some questions. Also, I think, by the way, is another possible explanation for the success. The marketing of this film was brilliant. Starting with the title, American Sniper. Hurt Locker is a phrase from military jargon that people would know, and they'd have to wait to see the TV ads to understand that it's a war film. Same thing, Lone Survivor could have been a story about somebody on a desert island. Fury was another one, this set in World War II, that was the title's ambiguous. But American Sniper, I mean, when you go to see that film, you know exactly what you're going to see. That kind of clarity of marketing sets an audience up to sit down and get into exactly what it's about. And so the marketing was excellent. And titling films is an often overlooked art. I mean, it really takes great thought.
Well, it's interesting because, Clint Eastwood appears to have defied the conventional wisdom and decided not to hide the identity of this movie as some of these others did, which does make this a moment in time that's right to say, hey, this is a war movie and audiences are going to respond. Robert McKee, thanks so much.
You're quite welcome, John. Thank you.
Robert McKee is an award-winning author and lecturer on the art of film. He was talking to The Takeaway's John Hockenberry.
Let's say you've got a great idea that would make your city a better place to live. What do you do next to make your voice heard?
You could attend a city council meeting.
Or you could tweet directly at the mayor. At least that's what Mesa is hoping its residents will do.
The show's Annika Klein explains how the city of Mesa is using social media to build community projects from the ground up.
The Mesa Urban Garden is filled with plants.
They grow so much faster if you pick them.
Adaro Safiri Anderson comes here about 5 times a week to tend to them. She walks me through the garden as she snips off greens.
As long as we leave that turnip in the ground, he will keep giving me greens.
The garden started 2 years ago. Back then, the 98 garden plots were just rectangles of dirt. But the idea for this community space was actually planted online.
It was about 2.5 years ago.
That's when Ryan Winkle had an idea. Along with a few other interested people, Winkle pitched that idea to the city on a website called iMesa. Much like in an election, citizens voted on the ideas, but also like an election, turnout was weak.
We had all of our friends go on and vote on it. And since there wasn't big usage of the site, well, there was decent usage, but I mean, there wasn't a whole lot. So we pretty much got the votes.
And the votes turned into support from the city, which Winkle says they couldn't have succeeded without. Also from IMESA, the renovations to Pioneer Park, which are slated for construction this spring. But when Mayor John Giles took office a few months ago, he realized the city needed to rethink its online strategy. The thing is, the crowdsourcing model worked, but you had to visit the site to participate. Giles says it made more sense to get to users through their social media.
And so it was kind of a, you know, duh moment when we realized, why are we working so hard to send people over to this corner of the internet? Why aren't we just getting in the middle of where they're at by using social media?
So the city started by using the hashtag NextMesa to get that dialogue going. It's not trending yet, but the city hopes soon community-driven projects will be. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
And while we're on the subject of Twitter, why not follow KJZZ for updates on the show? Our handle is at KJZZ Phoenix.
For a lot of us, when we think of puppet shows, we think of kids' birthday parties. But the Feld can really fly at the Great Arizona Puppet Theater's Puppet Slams, which take on more adult themes like their puppet predecessors.
What's wrong with you?
It's either this show or indigestion. I hope it's indigestion.
Why?
It'll get better in a little while.
I was surprised to learn that you and Teddy Roosevelt had something going.
Yes, I found out why he was called Rough Rider.
I like romantic things like music and art. And as you know, I have a gigantic heart. So why don't I have a boyfriend? It sucks to be me.
Me too.
That was Statler and Waldorf from The Muppets, Madam of Wayland and Madam, and Kate Monster of Avenue Q. For more, and don't worry, it's a G-rated conversation, I spoke with Gwen Bonner, the Great Arizona Puppet Theater's assistant artistic director, and her mom, the theater's director, Nancy Smith, and asked them how they got the idea to do adult puppet shows.
We've always known that puppets weren't just for kids, and we like them, and we're involved in the larger puppetry community and have seen a lot of things done for adults. And we had the idea, actually, the idea for us came when we were located over on 7th Street, and we were sharing a space with Playwrights Workshop Theater, and there were also poetry slams held at that space. And we said, oh, we should have a puppet slam. And we kind of thought, what would that be? I don't know. So it ended up being individual, different puppeteers creating short pieces and presented together with themes that were more for adults.
So how does a show for adults, a puppet show for adults, differ, other than the content, obviously, than a show for kids?
Well, our puppet slams are short-form adult puppetry, so you're not going to see any pieces that are usually anything longer than 10 minutes. So as far as our kids' shows goes, those are going to be full half-hour to hour-long presentations. I mean, obviously, you're going to have more adult themes. A lot of the times when people ask me, I think they're really scared. I think they think they're going to see something extremely X-rated and there's going to be a bunch of full frontal puppet nudity or something, you know. But it's really just adult themed. I tell a lot of people that the funny things that they're going to see is like what you would see on Adult Swim. You know, it's just not for kids. And then sometimes it might be political. So it's anything that's just not for kids, I suppose. You know, whether it's an adult theme, sometimes they're completely there's no spoken word in it at all and it's just done entirely to movement. So it's just the art of puppetry that's being pushed towards, you know, more of an adult audience than the children's audience, I suppose.
Is it in some ways easier and perhaps in some ways harder to do that with puppets as opposed to live people?
I don't know.
No.
No,
we like to say, you know, that there are some theaters that did not have time to make their puppets. But no, I think puppets can do so much, and they can say things that people can't. And I mean, we're puppeteers, so it's just like what we do.
Yeah.
But they have a lot of capabilities that actors sometimes don't. I mean, I'm not talking bad about actors. I'm just joking about that.
Is it hard to go back and forth doing adult shows and kid shows? I know you do a lot more kid shows than adult shows, but, I mean, do you ever worry about, like, saying something accidentally during a kid show that was maybe meant for the adult show?
Oh, man. So I do this... I do this show called The Monkey and the Pirate, and I've also adapted and done an adult version of The Monkey and the Pirate that might have a little bit more lewd language into it. But I'm... I've been doing kids shows for a long time, you know? And it's just, it's just like any other adult where all of a sudden you're around children and that switch turns on and you're in the game. You know what I mean? But at the same time, it's kind of cool because, you know, you work with kids all the time. And so you're just minding your P's and Q's. And then all of a sudden you can kind of let loose a little bit with the adult shows.
It seems like in some ways this kind of format is almost going back to some of the roots of puppetry, right? Because like Punch and Judy, for example, while it's often performed at birthday parties, it can be kind of violent and kind of not for kids. Yeah. So, I mean, do you guys take this in some ways as going back to sort of the roots of puppetry?
Absolutely. I think, I mean, that's just like what you were asking us, like, where does this come from? And it's always been here. But, puppetry got this whole thing where it was, oh, no, that's just for kids. And I've even seen as a professional puppeteer for children that even as lately that we've had parents be like, well, but is my 7-year-old going to like it? And it's like, 7-year-old's prime, actually,
Are they too old for puppetry?
Yeah, no. And so it's kind of strange. And I've been interested in really bridging that gap, too, between where it's like, because right now I feel like it's like, okay, 8 and 9 is good for children's puppetry. And then all of a sudden we go into adult puppetry. So where's my gap between 10-year-olds and 18-year-olds? Let's find something for them too. So I think it's always been there. And I think people just kind of ignored it for a while and forgot that, oh, wait a minute, those were puppets in Star Wars, you know? Like all of this stuff has still been there. We just haven't been able to realize it because we were too busy believing in them, really.
That was Gwen Bonner, Assistant Artistic Director of the Great Arizona Puppet Theater. We also heard from her mom, Nancy Smith, the theater's director. Their puppet slams are generally held the first Friday and Saturday nights of the month.
We take a moment now to recognize that Phoenix lost one of its musicians, and KJZZ lost one of its family members this week. Paul Anderson, who you probably heard bringing you jazz in the late hours of the night, passed away on Tuesday.
He was an accomplished saxophonist who got his start playing jazz standards to patients at a mental health facility in New York State. He will be missed. This piece we're hearing right now is from his CD called Moving Forward. Be sure to join us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock for the show, a new project to report along the entire stretch of the Arizona-Mexico border. We'll also visit another of the valley's threatened places. Those stories, much, much more tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the show.
For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is next. Thanks for listening. It's 3 o'clock.